The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Sorry, listening audience. Welcome to Race Treaty. It's 12/11/2015, and we haven't been here in a few weeks, but tonight we have a very special guest, Sister Dawati from the subcommittee. Actually, she's the chair of the subcommittee for the elimination of racism, the NGO Committee on Human Rights. And tonight's show is going to debrief, hopefully, on the commemoration event that took place the 3rd, I do believe. And again, we're focused on the International Decade for the People of African Descent. So welcome, sister.
Thank you. So glad to be here, my brother.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, Anaji, Brother Anaji wasn't able to host this evening. And I was very honored to listen to your last exchange on race treaty with Anaji. And you covered a lot of grounds that certainly perked my interest. And I was looking forward to having an opportunity to engage you in a follow-up on a couple of the issues. But if you'll share with us some of your workings and the connection with the International Decade and this 50th year convention, which doesn't seem to get the mainstream media coverage here in the U.S. And I'd like our audience to know that much work is being done on the international arena, and you being a very much a hero leading that way as sisters are globally. And I'm very proud to support that. So can you introduce your work?
Certainly. Thank you for that that beautiful introduction, first of all. I am someone who wears a lot of hats, but in this regard, actually they're kind of related. One is I'm a priest of the Afro-Atlantic traditions. I'm a priest of Haitian Vodou. And Vodou is not only a religion and spiritual way of being in the world, it's a very political way of being in the world, and it's a very Pan-African discipline. A form of spirituality that is about liberation. A lot of people don't understand that, but it's about liberation and about reparations in the sense of preparing ourselves and remembering our ancestors. Secondly, as a human rights activist, I do serve as the chair of the Subcommittee for the Elimination of Racism of the NGO Committee for Human Rights. The subcommittee was founded in 2000, just before the World Conference Against Racism that took place in Durban, South Africa, in 2001. And that was that big conference that a lot of people have forgotten about, and we can't afford to forget about it. But we ended up forgetting about it, many of us, because it was crushed, if you will, by the war, quote unquote, against terrorism. The event of September 11th overshadowed this major conference where you had thousands of people who have been the historic victims of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, coming together in solidarity to say no more, enough,
yes.
And we're going to change the world order, basically. You
yes.
know, so we, wow. in anticipation of this conference, the subcommittee was organized, and you know, and we've been the only entity at the United Nations that has been fighting against racism within that context.
Well, you know, there I'm aware of individuals that were in Durban, and
mm-hmm.
I followed that very closely. And one of my closest poems, actually, I may share this evening yet, concerns Durban and 911. And I saw the great fear of the U.S. and Israel walking out of that conference as they sought to universalize the definition of racism and codify it, and meaning that it became a legal a definition that could be used in world courts. And the U.S. and Israel walked out, if I'm not correct, mistaken. And that 911, as you said, squash. As I've talked to Dr. Vernelia Randall about this too, she very disappointed in that this 911 and the whole subsequent wars and change in our social structure in terms of rights and privacy and the rest is all upstaged that monumental event where there was great expectations and hope. Revisiting that though now and on the with the onset of the decade, it's only appropriate that those same issues, the universalizing the issues, be brought back up into the world's view going into this decade. And so this is a very, very important crossroads that we're at now going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to the recent convention or the recent gathering at the UN, the Trustee Council, Combating Racism in the 21st Century? What is
yeah.
there a plan? Is there a plan attached to that? Is there a plan that the grassroots can attach to that? Is there a plan that can attach to the Black Lives Matter movement? Or, you know, I'm curious to know the depths of this gathering or the intent behind it so we can get behind you.
Okay, thank you. The initial intent of this was it's like a debriefing. It's a debriefing where members of the NGO community, meaning non-government organizations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Non-government organizations are the equivalent of a not-for-profit. And at the UN, organizations that are accredited with the UN have these weekly meetings that take place. And they, some of these organizations were grassroots organizations, but they're no longer grassroots. They're no longer community-based organizations, although a lot of them can still operate in that capacity. But these meetings really are for, again, entities that belong to organizations that are not parts of government, but end up influencing policy within the UN. And lobbying for different causes within the UN. But we do, keep them open, they're public, so that anyone can participate. And we organized this, debriefing, this subcommittee, because we knew there were two important things that were converging historically. One is the 50th anniversary of the International Convention for the Elimination of Racism, whose anniversary was really, if I'm not mistaken, it was yesterday, or it will be actually on the 21st of December.
Right.
This convention was founded in 1965, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this big convention that, again, based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, said that there was to be no more discrimination against all forms of racial discrimination against people. Right. So that those international laws have been on the books 1965. Mm-hmm. Fast forward, we also have the International Decade for People of African Descent that was launched. This is the inaugural year. It's the first year, the end of the first year of the decade. The International Decade began in 2015. It ends in 2024. Now, for those of you who don't know, the decade came out of a struggle, preceded it when we had the International Year for People of African Descent in 2011. And that came out of that, the initial struggle.
Yes.
In 2001. The Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan. That was the outcome document of the World Conference Conference Against Racism. So everything is a struggle. So we get these two things, and both of them represent international laws. The Durban Declaration is more of a moral mandate. We don't have enough member states who have ratified it, including the United States, including, of course, Israel, Canada, France, the kind of usual suspects. And again, this ties into the walkout that took place in 2001, the U.S. government in Israel took the position that the conference and everything about it was anti-Semitic. That wasn't the case. Now,
yeah.
were there instances of anti-Semitism within civil society? Yes, you did see that. But this was also tied into some a longer set of issues where Israel had been providing guns to the South Africans during the apartheid regime, and of course Israel maintaining its own form of apartheid against the Palestinians.
Yes.
And so there's a complex history there. It wasn't about singling out Israel, but about taking a stand against the transatlantic slave trade, colonialism everywhere, especially amongst against people of color, and apartheid.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, to be clear, sister, it's very complex because, from my understanding, also that Israel, they were attempting to define the term racism to include and integrate it with anti-Semitism as it might like being the same. And I saw that dynamic play out online and it's kind of fallen off now, but there's an attempt to control the narrative of the language and the definitions also as applied to law. And speaking of law, you're right. The U.S. Has been part of this treaty, allegedly ratified it in 1995 under Clinton? The Sur Treaty, I should be more specific. The convention to eliminate racial discrimination. Yes. And
yeah.
we there's no enforcement obviously of that treaty law. And in fact the trigger in terms of disparate outcomes and disproportionality for the human rights law is really kind of veiled in the fact that the US doesn't even keep that data. The Guardian newspaper in England keeps the data on the police killing and started to aggregate that information, which is information I would think that should be supplied to the United Nations also, rather than just rendering the back and forth of the UPR and the shaming process. How do we get teeth into the process? Because I don't defend the UN, but I do defend international law and human rights. And from that lens, I always get the counter argument that there's no teeth there, that, you know, for all the pomp and circumstance, that the result is just a shaming where the U.S. government just blows things off and that there's no power behind the law. Now, that kind of has been discussed also amongst legal minds that said that you can enact CERD and these human rights laws into local municipal law and have some power from grassroots up, bottom up. But what is the possibility of getting an audience with the U.S. to actually address the issue of white supremacy and not cherry-picking the issues? All are important and all are maladies of white supremacy. And I'm not talking just police killings. I'm talking in all areas of people activity, which is the system of white supremacy. How do we get some accountability to that legal treaty that the U.S. signed and doesn't function under? It's very frustrating to defend the race treaty when, in fact, people have abandoned it. Although I find hope that our people movements are embracing a human rights lens. Speaking of Black Lives Matter, so we can come out of that intentionality framework of civil rights and get into the disproportionality and disparate impact, right, of international law. We're born with human rights and we're given civil rights by the state. So there's a great need to push behind the mandates and the efforts on your level and in your offices. And I don't feel isolated. The people are watching, and I would love to find out how, you know, this fits into the mass movement that's going on, both the Black on Campus, which is a new phase, and obviously Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
I'm just running my mouth. I want to talk to you. I know. Well, pick and choose and just kind of go with it, because you got the feel.
I mean, first, let's go back to the issue of semantics of language. There are people in Israel who have been trying to control the nature of the narrative, so that it isn't just an issue of tying in anti-Semitism to racism. We can go back and forth about that forever, because race is a social construct. It's a social construct. It's not a biological reality. Okay, there's more difference between myself as a woman and yourself as a man physically than there is between us as African descendants and somebody with paler skin. So, you know, people can argue up the wazoo all they want to about race and anti-Semitism on one hand. On the other hand, we can agree to that, all right? That's not an issue. But we're also, on our end, as African descendants, making an argument for the notion of Afrophobia. That Afrophobia is a distinct phenomena. It is a part of racism, but it is a distinct phenomena, and acts of violence, brutality, and psychosocial trauma that manifests itself in disparities in education, housing, health, et cetera, et cetera. But it is an act of violence, be it physical or otherwise, that is projected against the African person. And by the African person, I'm talking about the global African community. And it doesn't matter if you're from the African continent, from the Caribbean, Europe, South America, North America, Africa.
So that's one.
It gets a little bit deeper than that, because even the use of the word Holocaust and diaspora were being contested by that. So this is an issue that is losing its ground. And I think the more we write and articulate our narrative and make it clear that nobody has possession of those words, like diaspora, Holocaust. And if you look at their meetings, if we want to go down that road, we can argue the only person who's allowed to use the word Holocaust, because Holocaust has to do with death by fire. are the Japanese who were subject to the bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Crimes against humanity have been committed, and the worst crime, and the biggest crime, and the longest crime against humanity is the one that was conducted against the people of African descent during the transatlantic slave trade. That was one of the critical pieces, articles, if you will, of the Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan. And because this crime against humanity was cited, that opened up the door to reparations, which is why, the real reason why, the United States walked out. And the subsequent dismantling, of individuals and organizations that were involved in this process, character assassinations, but also taking away people's funding and other things have taken place because at the heart of this is the issue of reparations and how the procuring reparations will change the world order. So Israel becomes a foil. Israel becomes an excuse for things. So this is where things get twisted. It was really about reparations. And so if we want to put peace in this, because I am one of these people who talked about, all right, the U.S. has ratified ICERD, but then why is it that we needed to have a Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan? Because nothing was coming out of it. And and really one cannot enforce in some ways international law. The only way that things can be enforced, yes, is through shame, through sanctions. But every state has its sovereignty, although certain states seem to be more sovereign than others, because they take full advantage of everything that they have to impose their will on others. And unfortunately, the U.S. is among those states. At the end of the day, it becomes increasingly difficult to manage what happens, especially in a place like the UN, because the U.S. is the bully here. And because people of African descent almost universally don't have sufficient material resources to counter what happens at the UN and the position of the U.S. and France and the G7 countries who basically determine what goes on in there, we continue to get pulverized in some way. We get our butt kicked one way or another. So it is important to bring in the masses there. And so one of the reasons why we hosted this discussion at the UN is, believe it or not, there are non-government organizations, NGOs, people who are members of civil society who don't know anything about ICERD or the DDPA. ICERD, again, being the International Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination and the Durban Declaration and Program of Action Plan. They don't know. So we had to let them know. So it's like the people who are closest to us, who are supposed to be like us in civil society, need to be aware of what the issues are, what the laws are. And in fact, racism and its intersectional elements, its places of intersectionality, is racism in small arms, i.e. the gun control. There's racism and settlements. Think of settlements in terms of gentrification, housing, where people live. There's racism at the intersection of gender violence. There's racism at the at the intersection of the rights of the child, of the right to education, and culture. Groups that might be fighting for any one of these things that don't consider the issue of race have to be made aware of where and how this is an issue. And part of the reason why people don't think about these things is because a lot of times there are not enough of us as people of African descent involved directly in this kind of discourse in the place like the UN. On the grassroots level, we're on it. But not within the confines of the UN. And so our next step involves two things. One is making the subcommittee a standalone committee, so that we're not under the umbrella of the NGO Committee for Human Rights, which will empower us to do other things. And among those things would be to, for instance, invite grassroots organizations like Black Lives Matter.
Scotty, did we lose her?
I beg your pardon? I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said. Hello?
No, we did not lose her. Brother Robin, are you unable to hear her? Sister DeWoody?
I'm still here.
Yes, I know. We lost him. Give me just a second. Oh. It's trying to call him back. He must have had a bad connection and his internet dropped. This is Scotty. I'm the producer and technical producer, I should say. So if
are we still on the air?
Yes, we are. Please continue.
Okay. Well, if I may, and I hope everyone can hear clearly. What I was saying is that as a committee, we can bring in grassroots organizations, can begin to bring them into the space, and help acquire the kind of credentials that people are going to need to have their voices heard inside of the UN to influence member states, but also to help figure out a way where, for those of us who are on the inside, I can work more closely with those who are on the outside, because we're both being impacted in either case. There is a form of structural racism that exists even within the UN itself. And that's one of the things that I alluded to, in the, on the November 3rd event.
Yes, while we wait for him, it seems like he is offline. I can continue on, with the program. And to your point, that is a question that I have always asked. You know, Malcolm X, and I'm not sure if he was the first person, African descendant person from the United States to propose that we take our grievances to the UN.
No.
But.
Yeah.
Well, what I was going to say was that I have often questioned, well, what's the purpose of going to the UN? Because I see the UN practicing racism. Globally, they seem to back or co-sign or rubber stamp things that the United States does. Do we have you back, Brother Robin?
Hello? Well, that is a point that you make, and part of my, an excellent point that you make, and part of my talk was about the gap. So there's a bunch of things that have to be done, and we need to talk about that for the decade. But among the gaps is addressing issues such as structural racism within, as of course, and outside of the United Nations, but contradictory policies that exist, such as UN occupation, the peacekeepers in Haiti, for example. You have the first Black Republic, celebrated its bicentennial, years ago, and is under occupation, by the UN. But the UN is also occupying, Blue Helmets are occupying other, countries where people of African descent are as well. So there is a contradiction that is there, and that's part of what has to be, addressed. Absolutely. But again, one of the ways that this gets addressed is by having more of us, the people of African descent, globally engaged, involved, and taking the resources that we have. Because part of the reason why the U.S. is able to bully people around at UNESCO, at the UN, and elsewhere is because, you know, either people, either the state uses its dues or it takes away its dues. You know, and it's the same way that everybody decided after the George Zimmerman trial, hey, we're going to boycott Florida. That made a difference. But then also on so-called Black Friday, we're going to boycott that.
Mm-hmm.
So people have living wages. That makes a huge difference. So the use of resources matters, and black folks have to decide, people of Africa have to decide, you know, again, where are we going to use our money? Where are we going to invest our hard-earned dollars? And to what extent that we can take those dollars and support the organizations that are doing the work for us on the ground and in other places, institutions, world institutions, stages such as the UN. Now, for all of the problematics of the UN, it is still an enormously important space. It is still the place where the bulk of humanity meets to negotiate its issues, so we have to be at the table.
Yes.
We gotta be in the room at the table. At the same time, that isn't sufficient. We have to build our own institutions of people of African descent, and institutions that come from a place of liberation, not from a place of oppression, not from a place where we are reacting to something, but from a place in which we know, okay, what's going on over here ain't working no more for us. You know, my ass up, plastic, you know, whatever language you speak, whatever cultural sensibilities that you have, acknowledging, that certain institutions, including the African Union, which again came from where? Oh, it was a response to colonialism, right? We have to decide, what does our freedom mean to us? What does it look like? What does our humanity look like? What does it mean to be human? I'm Haitian, so I would go back to my own culture. But for us, the word red, black, means human too. So anybody who is of African descent, that's a human being, period.
Sister,
our own places, our own cultures, and decide what that is and build institutions on those foundations.
I was cut off for a short period, but I was listening to you, and you know, there's two issues. One being that we've come to realize with Afrophobia, which African Americans don't really understand the dynamic of the global white supremacist system, and Afrophobia being its manifestation in Europe and other places, that in fact that anti-black racism
wait, I'm sorry. Why do you think it's just it's not here? Afrophobia exists here too.
Well, yeah, but they term it differently. Well, I should say they term it differently here as opposed to Afrophobia. They see it here as racism in general, and that's a problem in terms also because the global effect, as you said, is the fulcrum of racism is anti-black racism. It is the Afrophobia. That's the fulcrum, the core. And that seems to be denied and get mixed up with prejudice and discrimination. But by statistics and the history, the transatlantic slave trade, anti-black racism is a fulcrum. And not to jump to the next point, but you mentioned about the necessity of being in the international arena, and I agree wholeheartedly. But I'm on the watch of corporations that have now acquired human rights, and how are they functioning? Are they going to be petitioning countries in the UPRs and doing the shaming process, or are they given economic power in the international courts to now conduct litigation against countries and continue the white supremacy onslaught of our or the globalization process? I'm really curious about the plan to address the issue of human rights for corporations that are now granted.
Well, that is one aspect of a bigger of the bigger struggle. That is an enormous an obscene construct that we'll agree, except of course if you belong to a transnational. That these corporate giants have human rights. They're not human. They're not people. They're not a. They shouldn't have those rights. And it is up to us in civil society to make it clear to our government that that isn't the case, that that isn't acceptable, because for all kinds of reasons. Among which is how corporations use their resources, use their money, use whatever political influence they have, which is a great deal, unfortunately, and access to resources to continue accessing our resources, mm-hmm. and using those things, whether it's coltrane or diamonds or gold or coffee. Or cotton against us. But this isn't just a struggle for civil society. Our governments have to be held accountable too.
We recently celebrated.
Allow them to be in a position where such a ridiculous notion can exist. So we do have to get rid of people who are in office, who are not doing what we need, who are not protecting our interests. We need to find ways of supporting those in the electorate who have radical ideas to help us. But we're going to have to change our whole economic model and way of engaging in order to do this, because of the obscene amount of money it takes to be in a position of power anywhere in this country, no matter what level it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the same holds true, although the issue of money may not be as critical, but it does matter elsewhere too, in Africa and the Caribbean.
Surely.
So governments need to be held accountable for that. These corporations can't come in and literally steal everything that we have. You know, housing in this country, those are the numbers that came out this week, that again 1% of the population has more money in their hands than the entire population of people of African descent in this country. How does that happen?
And yet they have a power, that power system that was in our politics with the lobbying process. Recently there was the celebration of the 13th Amendment, and, you know, which is no celebration, is the trichnology and linguistic racism, again, with the exception clause. And then it brought me to think about the 14th Amendment, where when are they going to celebrate the slaves or so-called Emancipation Proclamation? What really happened was corporations were given personhood, and subsequent 104, I think, legal cases were built on the corporations empowering them by the government. And now the whole system has been reversed. And my question on a technical end is, on a legal end is, now that they've acquired human rights, we can argue the point that they shouldn't have it or not, they've acquired human rights, are they subject to the same human rights limitations that African-American citizens experience in having some type of enforcement of the violation of the law against white supremacy and racism?
I'm not a lawyer, but you also know what the answer to that question is. We can't talk about the master burning down his or her own house, all right? Because who are these corporations? What do their boards look like?
Right.
What do their boards look like? And what systems of power do they oversee? Media, infrastructure development, many educational systems, which are the localities of structural racism. So why would you expect, what difference does it make, what kind of so-called rights that they have, human or otherwise, not only because they're not human, but they are the power structure. Why are they going to fight against white supremacy and racism? It's not in their interest to do that. They wouldn't do that. We shouldn't even ask the question. We are still, I'm convinced that the African Senate in the United States of America, and I want to say America, America KKK.
Yes, ma'am.
I have to see that at this point. And while I'm saying that, I'm not saying this as the, I have to make a disclaimer, I'm not saying this as the chairperson of the subcommittee. I'm saying this is Dua Dizia, Mumble Dua Dizia, private citizen. We are still not recognized as fully formed human beings. We are still somehow three-fifths of a human being.
Thank you, yes.
The U.S. Constitution has not really changed that much. And to the extent that structural racism and systemic racism is in place, to the extent that these huge disparities exist with education, with housing, with health,
environment.
These are all indicators of our lack of humanity, all right? That we are not fully formed persons and are not entitled to rights. But the United States, even under Barack Obama, the first African, we can't say that he was the first president of African descent. There are people who are contesting that Eisenhower and others are African descendants, but the first one to admit that he is an African descent. All right. He's there, but we have not ratified the DDPA.
Right.
We didn't attend the United States. No, me, but I was there. But the United States didn't attend the even the review conference that took place 5 years ago. And now we're getting ready to celebrate next year the 15th anniversary of the Durban Declaration. The U.S. is still disengaged. Even the Congressional Black Caucus did not send one representative to Durban Plus 10.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if our own people who were supposed to be there supporting us are not.
That's because they're not our people.
Well, we have a proxy racism terminology for the psychological effects of assimilation and a buy-in to obtaining the holding the status quo. So we're really kind of cutting it really quite a fine line on the mentality to our self-determination here or the maintenance of white supremacy. So I think Scotty was kind of going to pipe in on that fact in that they don't seem to have a vested interest. But there's a question I wanted to ask you that I think is real important. First of all, we're called African-Americans because Jesse Jackson was promoted by his handlers to make a campaign for a change to designation of identity. In terms of it allowing us as a people to enter into the world course in the international arena as a people, kind of been neutralized. Now, if we were a nation within a nation, there would be an economic package attached to our sitting at the tables at the United Nations in terms of our self-determination and identity. And that hasn't come about. That could have came about in the Million Man March if you would have passed a brown bag around and created a plebiscite right there to declare that, although what was declared was that we want to boycott, yes, the economic system. We don't want to give our money and tell lies about a white man, unemployed white man bringing you gifts, but we want to get 2 million acres. But with that comes a power and economic base attached. Otherwise, we're stuck to lamentations and solicitations to shame the United States who, as you said, don't even see us as humans. It's built into their foundation as a system here in the United States. And so in any adherence to international law, it's not going to come voluntarily. That's true. But our positioning as a people here in the United States under all these human rights violations going on, we have no teeth in responding to the onslaught on us. And in the denial, we have to fight to get past through mainstream media and the lack of acquiring data in all the areas you were speaking of, from education, law enforcement, all areas of people activity, racism exists. We don't have the data in all areas to see the algorithm of this moving negative energy grid that encompasses us. How do we get to the international arena without an identity, more than sitting in committees as a body with an economic base attached like indigenous folks? How does that happen?
But we do have an identity. It's a question of whether or not you want to embrace the same way that we're, you know, here. We are 13% of the population and have $1.1 trillion in buying power, okay? You don't have to use that money to, I don't know, to buy the latest Air Jordans or whatever people put on their PCs.
Right.
we can use that money and buy land. I live in New York State. I know that if you buy 100 acres of land, you can set up your own town. You know, you can have your own municipality. We need to do that. We need to own the land. And perhaps, you know, I'm not saying that everybody's got to pack up their stuff and we're all going to go to, I don't know, upstate New York or Alabama. There are these logistical issues that cannot be addressed. But at the same time, we are in a position to create a virtual universe where we do have a very distinct identity, but it is the issue of being an African descendant. Let's not forget that our movements are Pan-African, that each step towards liberation was informed by another. Whether it was someone like Queen Ndinga, you know, in Angola, in the 16th, 17th century, fighting against colonialism. That is part of our struggle. Binko Bahio, who was an African rebel leader in 1621, founded the first free town in the Americas, the San Basilio de Palenque in Colombia, Langa Zumba and Zumbidos of Palmares in Brazil. All of these struggles, Denmark VC, Where did that conspiracy come from? Where was he getting his instructions from? Mm-hmm. He was getting it from IT, from Haiti. So we were communicating and building and supporting and fighting for our liberation. So ultimately, it was a Pan-African one. We cannot lose sight of that. That's why we use the word African descendant. Okay?
Right.
And then, and then there are people who are like, well, shoot, I ain't black. Because his skin is the color of ginger. There are people who are Asian.
We buying into that paradigm. Yeah.
So the general term is you are an African descendant. And an African descendant also includes Africans who were born in the African continent because you are a descendant of that continent. You still live there. And we don't need to get into this topic about, well, gee, the first men and women came from the African continent, and so we're all African descendants. Yeah, we know that. That's what then, we understand.
So that's the base.
At the end of the day, those of us with pigmentation of a certain sort, with certain features, are the ultimate victims of Afrophobia and racism.
We're in very, very important times because we're in this decade, which is an opportunity to get beyond celebration and lamentation and benchmark some plans of action globally to confront white supremacy. It's an organizing opportunity and to resurrect the Durban and bring that back into play in terms of surge and tie the social movement.
It isn't just white supremacy. It's white supremacy and it's capitalism. It's also capitalism.
You can't have capitalism without racism. That's true. It's not, and I see them both.
I said race. I said capitalism.
That's ran by corporations. We understand that. And corporations who sit and control those support.
It isn't just that. It is every time we make a decision to spend money on ourselves or those of us who have lost our minds in supporting somebody like Donald Trump, all right?
We can become rich,
too. This is a manifestation of capitalist thinking. We have bought the hokey-dokey. We have drank the Kool-Aid that way. Many of us have done that.
Deprogramming is in order. Deprogramming is in order. I mean, that's part. I neglected to point out the fact that we bought into this assimilation monoculture, celebrate his same merchants' holidays, give over our money. And as you said, we represent like the ninth richest country in the world, but we control no industries, own less than 3.1% of the land. And if we spend all of our time consuming other folks' products, that all flies in the face of self-determination. And you can't get past the materialism that is attached to our value system now without a deprogramming process. And I attach that to reparations, that we set up a mental health institution network to address our own maladies as a result of this post-traumatic slave disorder and its manifestations. And you're right. As long as kids is killing each other over a name brand and killing each other over material things, and then we're going out and spending our ninth richest country in the world potential in the richest country as purely consumers. And I don't know if there's a fear coming out of the Black Wall Street experience that when we did engage in self-determination, white supremacy rose its head and they used their technology to drop dynamite from planes and to destroy a thriving community that didn't need them. And so, you know, I don't know if that's the fear factor subconsciously about our inability to exercise our economic leverage. You going to say something, Scotty?
Yeah, I just wanted to make both of you aware, in case you were not aware, as this has just recent SEC rules, and I know the complexity of the situation, and perhaps it might sound like hypocrisy, like we're going to use capitalism to fund our freedom or whatnot, but the SEC, that's the Security and Exchange Commission, on October the 30th issued new rules covering crowdfunding. Okay, as before, I just did an interview with Brother Marlon Adams of CulturalGrassroots.com, and he's setting up a black crowdfunding website or portal. Now, the way crowdfunding worked before was like, okay, you got a great idea. I want to see you succeed. I got $10 and I'm going to donate. And then 10 million other people donate $10. Now, they were just donors. They might have got a T-shirt, as the way he described it, or a coffee cup or a thank you letter or something like that. But now with the new rules governing crowdfunding issued by the Security and Exchange Commission, now you can raise investment capital, whereas those people will no longer just be donors. They will be investors in the company. And I saw that as a way for us to even get around, black entrepreneurs get around going to the bank, where we know they practice racism and white supremacy with this discriminatory loan practices. But it's a way for us to take that $1 trillion and invest it in black business building. And I didn't know if you all were aware of that new rule. What do you see the potential being?
Let me speak to that, Scotty. It's an exercise of collective capitalism, which is the only way that we can really operate with any power base collectively. And it opened up the doors for that. I am familiar with that. And the idea of joint equity or public equity in businesses, I call that social enterprise. It's kind of like opened up the door for that possibility also. And that's something that we need to really, really focus in on in supporting each other, but not just engage in capitalism, but to really understand our potential collectively. That's what the piece is missing.
Well,
we brought
right,
into
yeah, but mm-hmm. Exactly, but all that is doing is this is an opportunity for us to go again, to go back to cultural ways. All right. Mm-hmm. If you're from the Caribbean, you are familiar with the notion of susu. That is a collective coming together. And putting its resources in one place, or in several places, to yield specific outcomes. But every week we make a commitment to, or every month we make a commitment to putting mm-hmm. in a certain amount of dollars to build, equity for, one person or, mm-hmm. or one community. But it revolves. What about capitalism? You shouldn't be afraid to say the other word. You know, the other word that we decided that we were made to feel was, you know, uniquely anti-American is a communitarian way of thinking, a communitarian way of engaging in the world, where it is about you and not about me. Because capitalism is always about me, and it doesn't matter how much perfume you put on it, how you structure it, what you call it, it's still about me. Setting up this kind of crowdsourcing is a communitarian way of thinking and being in the world. It is in fact part of a very African construct, called Ubuntu. That notion that I am, because you are.
Yeah.
It is about setting up again, thinking about what does the community need? What do we all need to survive? How are we going to get that? How are we going to achieve this mm-hmm. end? We need to take the step. We need it. We need that. So we put up the mechanisms. We facilitate. We nurture these things. That's what has to get done. And we're afraid to go there because of issues of trust, because we are made to think, at least in this country, that thinking in as a collective, is dangerous. The notion of a certain number of people of African descent coming together, more than five, is always a scary thing. The laws of this country have changed, and were developed around, in a way, preventing us from coming together. But even in even if you look at the music industry, for instance, how we no longer have groups. Everybody's a solo artist. That is about persuading this notion of working together as a collective. We can't lose sight of that. And this is part of what I'm talking about in terms of founding institutions that are based on traditional, traditional is not a good word, but historic forms of social organization. So we don't need the SEC to do that, but the fact that the SEC has opened up its doors, if you will, legally, and has enabled this to happen, then by all means we should take advantage of that. But we should also understand that historically our societies have often operated this way and still do. Only we are made to feel as if, oh, this is what poor people do. This is what evil people do. Or this is a communist or socialist way of doing things.
Right.
And that's dangerous. We've got to get away from that.
I have a question that Brother Naji and I had discussed. You had mentioned bringing a reconciliation commission similar to South Africa to the U.S.
We had proposed setting up a truth and reconciliation hearing as part of an exercise of what we wanted to happen during the course of the decade. yeah, something along what has happened in South Africa, but better. Better in the sense that I spoke to, and I personally have spoken to people who participated in the Truth and Reconciliation commissions in South Africa, and it left people feeling a little angry, a little frustrated, and it's like, what was the point of all this? Yeah, we got to purge ourselves, but there's still no sense of justice being realized. So yes, this is something we want to be able to do, and we're going to be exploring the best ways to make that happen. And partnering, and in fact, this is one of the things that and ways in which we can partner with grassroots organizations all over the U.S., but also there's a large Afro-European population whose human rights and civil rights movements have been ignored, but it's an important one. And we can work with our brothers and sisters in Latin America to gather that kind of intelligence,
yes,
and to create a space where we can talk about what Afrophobia has done to us and what we want to see happen to change that. And we can begin also to use like a citizens, create a citizens database for getting the kind of disaggregated information that we need. The kind of information that lets us know, first of all, how many of us there are. You know, like in Latin America, for instance, this is one of the reasons why we use the word African descendant.
Uh-huh.
There's so many different color categories, so-called racial categories. And those categories exist to not only further dehumanize us, but to separate and segregate us and to make us think the less African we are, the better we are. When we change the image and the notion of what being an African is, and we buy and believe in our own selves and our pride and our beauty and our strength, then you have a huge shift, like what happened in Brazil, where all of a sudden, 51-52% of the Brazilian population is identifying itself as African descendant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Those numbers, when you have 150 million people, over 150 million people, makes a huge difference in terms of confronting structural racism, mm-hmm, and personal day-to-day racism as well. Whereas in on the European continent, we have a European Union, so all member states, you know, function, they share, they share resources in terms of a common a currency, they travel within European states without visas, all of these things facilitate creating unity. But there's this, mm-hmm, notion of republicanism, especially in a place like France, where you're French, you're French, and that's it. And it doesn't matter if you're Muslim, it doesn't matter if you're African, it doesn't matter if you're Asian, you're French, and that's it. On paper, that's the truth. But in reality, that is not the truth. And so we have no idea how many African descendants there are, be they immigrants or families that have been there for generations. We can't keep track of them. We don't know what those numbers are. And when you don't know what the numbers are, then you don't know how to use those numbers effectively. So we need that kind of disaggregated data to take place. And setting up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission is the way that enables us to begin, however informally, to get a sense of what those numbers are. And I think we know that we're in a better position to leverage that to our advantage. This is such a critical issue. People don't understand. There are about 1 billion, probably more, but let's say 1 billion people of African descent in the world. And do you know at the UN we're not considered a major group? We're not considered a major group. the world has maybe 7 billion people.
But that's global, right? That's global. Yeah, not only at the UN, we're minorities globally.
Exactly. We're not even, this issue of minority doesn't mean anything. Legally, it doesn't mean anything. Because, if there were 1 billion Chinese, 1 billion whites, 1 billion whatevers, it doesn't mean anything. Nobody's a minority here. but 1 billion people, you know what I mean? This is a huge number. But if we are not even recognized as a major group and a force to be reckoned with, in a world stage like the UN, then again, this contributes to the kind of social trauma that we experience. Mm-hmm. It contributes to the sense that these people don't matter. We can do whatever we want. We can go in their countries and steal their resources. We can shoot them all over the place. And act with impunity. Whatever kinds of transgressions people feel they can take against the African person is allowed when we don't know how many we are, how powerful we are, and we don't know how huge we are when we're not recognized, again, within in institutions such as the UN. So these things it's got to change, and we have to make those changes take place.
I'm very, very hopeful. Truth invokes the need for data in all areas of people activity as relates to racism and instances of it, not only in government, but civil society and corporations, and globally, as you said. Reconciliation. How do we have reconciliation unless reparations is on the table? So does this this truth and reconciliation encompass the reparations issue?
Reconciliation, is it possible without reparations?
That's my question,
I think because the issue of reparations is such a divisive one, I would have to say no, one is not possible without the other. If it's not reparations, then we need there's compensation, there is restitution. There are forms of restitution that are needed. Restitution could actually also facilitate reconciliation in our societies. But there are a lot of debates about how that will look. There are people who, you know, belong to, for me, what is the old school model of looking at things and saying, yeah, we want our check. Sure, you can get your check. Let's see who's going to give it to you. We can demand the check. But
you know what they did? They did it to Johnny Cochran, and he was amassing a brain trust of legalese and has started acquiring the information when he passed on, and his law firm was taken over with the same name, and his partners in the reparations preparations legally dismantled. And so there's this economic element to reparations, can be in the form of, as you say, restitutions or institution buildings, but it comes with the acknowledgement that a whole economic base, as we speak of capitalism, was based on the slave trade. I mean, work for me for 400 years, see what I can't build. So the restitution to use a language that is more acceptable, it seems like there should be some type of factoring in on this reconciliation of the reparations platform.
But we're also arguing that the nature of reparations isn't just about money. It has to be bigger than that. It has to be broader than that. Because otherwise you're putting a price on your head. And I don't know about you, but there's no price on my head.
I agree wholeheartedly, and the healing element is what we need help with, is the healing and the institutions to address that issue, because With disparate impact, people are not talking about the impact. That's the victim and the trauma that the victim endured and endures and needs to be addressed in that part of the human rights language as well, I would think, right?
Right, right. And part of the ways, one of the several ways that I think we can begin to secure compensation, restitution, reparations, and these are things that can probably be done, you know, within, say, a 2 to 3 year period. Things such as debt forgiveness for students of African descent, so that they're not going to enter, as so many millennials are, into a form of indentured servitude, because they take out these student loans that they can't pay back. So debt forgiveness, a free college education and graduate schools for those of African descent. These are things that could be done. If you are a homeowner, you're selling a property or you're buying, why are you paying taxes to the state and into the federal government? Especially when you sold something, you can give up as much as 40% of your capital gains in taxes. For me, I want that money. You owe me that. Let me keep my 40%. Okay.
Right. So that's creative financing of preparations.
So there's that financial structure that has to be put in place. It isn't just, we're forgetting something very fundamental. A lot of times it's money that we claim that we have, that the country claims that it has, the corporations claim that they have. It's artificial. It isn't based on actual cash. It's not based on gold. It's not, you know, it's not something concrete that is tangible. Because even cash is that can literally be burned somewhere. What does that mean? So it can easily be devalued. So there are these issues. Not to mention the fact that we've been demanding reparations for God knows how long in many cases. Yeah, and while that demand was made, a parallel phenomenon should have been taking place, which is to ready financial institutions to disseminate those monies to people of African descent. They're not going to do that, and then capitalism itself is not going to allow the practitioners of that kind of economics are not going to allow their money to be taken away because they become totally disempowered. The banks and these sorts of financial institutions become disempowered. So we've got to look at other things. We have to do things like educational reparations and restitutions where our histories are told from antiquity, not starting with the slave trade, because we were free people.
Immigrant workers. that's what they're calling us now in the school books.
That's bull donkey. So that young children are learning from day one who they are, who we are, what their people are, where they came from, where they could have come from. And that is a source of pride and empowerment. That's a critical thing. Museums and those kinds of institutions that house so much of our history and knowledge, let those objects and that information, go, let it out there and let us have access to it. Why should I have to go see, the Congo Power and Majesty show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art and pay $20 for that? These are my people. You stole this stuff from us. What I mean? Why do I have to pay you to see that? But my being in that space, looking at this phenomenal, it's more than art. It is a manifestation of Black power. Okay? It is now a manifestation African power that has retained itself throughout the Americas and has, and you know, through a black or African religiosity and African-based, African-based religion, enabled so many of us to survive the transatlantic slave trade and other atrocities that have taken place. We need to have access to these things. So this is a form of scholarly reparations, in addition to the educational reparations with what we learn in school. The financial structures, again, not paying taxes. Why should, for that matter, why should anybody who is of African descent who works, why are we paying taxes? Why are we paying taxes? We should be able to hold on to the money that we earn, especially when we are women, people of African descent, women of African descent who earn how much less than the dollar? You know, women in general earn much less than the dollar to their male counterparts, and then women of African descent earn even less. Why am I giving you my money? Excuse me?
That's an argument that goes all the way back to Lincoln. That Paul Cuffee was the first black millionaire who wrote a letter to Lincoln saying, well, why should I pay taxes when I'm not even considered a citizen or a human here? Yeah, so why are we even in that structure?
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. So these are all things that could be done, and we need to demand that our legislators do. Because the big check, that sounds sweet, but it hasn't happened.
Thank you for clearing that up.
Even a case like IET, where we paid the equivalent of $21 billion to France, Citibank demanded that we collected those funds from us. And we finished finally paying it off to France. And we demanded reparations under President Aristide. What did they do to us?
They
assassinated his character, boycotted our bicentennial, made us ashamed, and now we're being occupied by the Clintons.
And the NGO pedophiles. And
yeah. And so we have actual legal ground, and there's a paper trail that is both financial, legal, source, everything, and we haven't been able to get reparations.
Mm-hmm.
And we were founded in 1804.
Well, so, you know, in including reparations, though, while we talk about the reparations and all these formulas, we also need to create an insulation around our generation that won't be infected and inflicted with internalized inferiority, like you said, Sankofa,
exactly.
Take over our education. So we have to, while seeking reparations to in the healing aspect from the impact, the disparate impact, we also need to insulate our children going forward. We need a generation that won't bow to the vestiges of white supremacy in the educational process and attacking through media and otherwise their self-esteem and identity. So that's
right.
Amazing.
You know, it's Caricom, the Caribbean commercial market. The Caribbean states are now at the helm of the reparations movement and are going to be going to Europe and actually did already go to the UK. And we'll be going also in Europe to demand reparations. And of course, is saying no.
But they'll build a prison. They give you money to build a prison, though. Remember
exactly.
That?
Right, but it's like, oh, no, you know, let bygones be bygones. No. That's not going to happen. That's our position. We can't let bygones be bygones because part of the continued impact of the slave trade is illness. Obesity, diabetes, hypertension. These are direct results of slavery. And we are still suffering from that as a people throughout the Americas. So I realized at one point, like, egg. You know, they want, they being the forces of white supremacy, want us to forget we're going to get grown, and we're going to be yakking away about reparations. We're going to grow old and eventually die off. And then there's a younger generation of people who will be, Ripple what? Ripple who? What's that? Oh no, let's move beyond that. Let's not talk about that. We just want to be human beings. And
we
you know,
heard, yeah, well, we hear it every day.
We could all be human beings.
Yeah, but that's kumbaya. Kumbaya.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Yeah, and you might forgive and you might forget, and somebody might say, yes, yes, I acknowledge you and I embrace you as human beings, but it's not going to undo the systemic and structural racism that is in place. It is not going to undo the depth and the breadth of Afrophobia. Afrophobia has actual legal chemicals that go back as far as 1684. We can say it's earlier than that, but legally we can at least trace it through the Code Noir, known as the Black Codes and the Código Negro, if you're Spanish or Portuguese speaking. But this was a law that had the blessing of the church that brutalized and dehumanized the African person. You know, if you ran away, you were gone for 30 days and you were caught, you were going to get branded. If you did it again, they're going to, snip your Achilles heel.
Diagnose you with drapomania. They diagnose you with drapomania to infuse their psychological sciences. Yeah, right. We heard these things. Yeah, we know. It's a sickness.
But all of these acts of containment and the manipulation of the black body and its destruction and the black mind come from that was again 1684. We are now in the 21st century and we are still being shot down and treated like animals. We're still being excluded from the judiciary in places like Colombia. We're afraid to go to court if something happens to us. Our lands are still being taken away and we're still being called devil worshippers in places like Haiti and stigmatized in Suriname if we embrace African, traditional African-based religions. Our histories are ignored. In Europe, Black Pete, which is like basically a Sambo. In the Netherlands, how is that possible that we're still, this is still happening?
So, sister,
the reasons why a struggle has to remain a fundamentally un-African one, and we have to think about we, not just about me.
Madam Chairperson, the reason why I really wanted to be on this show with you tonight was to ask you this question: Is your subcommittee prepared to aggregate the data? For example, that the Guardian newspaper is doing in London of the U.S. police killings, but is your subcommittee prepared, because there's no U.S. organization doing this, prepared to aggregate data in all areas of people activity concerning this dynamic of Afrophobia and racism? Could that be done in preparations?
It can't actually. I can answer that very quickly. It cannot be done through our organization, at least not yet, because we need a tremendous amount of resources to make that happen, mm-hmm. and the expertise. There's some information that I am reading up on citizen data, and it's something that we did talk about. Well, how could we start to move towards that end? How can we
begin to
do that kind of work?
We would
welcome that. We're also setting up a social media intern that can help facilitate, gathering that kind of information. Because the numbers are needed. I mean, it's one of many tasks that has to take place. And to that end, even if the process of becoming accredited as a UN organization will take time, we can invite grassroots, and I am inviting grassroots organizations and individuals who are interested in eliminating racism and other forms of intolerance, and especially putting an end to Afrophobia and doing the kind of work that is going to result in some substantive change, be it enforcing existing international laws or creating new paradigms and new spaces for us that are going to further a quest for liberation by the end of the decade. We need to have some concrete things happen.
And, some benchmarks.
This isn't about party time. You know, we can party all we want to. This is about a party. This is about a war. And so we need people to work with us. And so even if it's about just setting up a task force that works with the subcommittee, which again is going to become a committee by next year, we can do that. And while people don't necessarily have to be in New York City to make that happen, we have technology. We have Skype, we have conference calls, we have Google on Hangout. There are all sorts of things that we can use. Tools that we can use to communicate, to exchange ideas, to get the work done, and to have something that is a well-oiled machine that can be used at the UN and outside of the UN. Because again, this is a global issue.
I want to plug Black Talk Radio Network in doing the work as alternative media focused on our issues. And my group, the Anti-Racism Media and Anti-Racism TV, where we'd like to get a 24/7 news channel based on racism and white supremacy and analyze the mainstream media for what it is. In reference to your aggregating, yes, I look forward to talking to you after the show and with Anaji on that aggregation possibility. I know a Six Sigma black belt, a brother from the Dalit background who's a genius that says it is possible to aggregate that information, but not on the website, but into a portal, which is just an area of all of the information that can be swiped. And so I'd like to speak with you about that going forward.
Oh, yeah.
And,
that's great. One of our speakers was from the Dalit community, D.B. Sabour. The International Dalit Commission.
Beautiful.
Yeah, so that kind of coalition building, that kind of solidarity building is critical.
Well, we've gone over a half hour of our usual show, and Scotty's been gracious. Can you join us again and continue the update, and perhaps maybe next time with Anaji, but continue to have a relationship with us, race treaties based on the work you do.
I would love to do that, and I thank you for your generosity that way. I would love to do that. We need to continue the dialogue. We need to get people involved, and we need help being told, okay, such and such a thing's happening over here, something else going on over there, because unfortunately there's just so much that is adversely impacting us, and we're just small subcommittee, and even when we become a committee, we're still going to be a small entity, but we're also going to need support to make these things happen, and that support will come in whatever way people can provide, your listeners can provide. So absolutely, I look forward to speaking with you on the radio again, and
thank you so
much. And off radio.
Thank you so much. Yes, I expect a call from me as a follow-up, and appreciate the work you do. Thank you, Scotty.
Thank you, Scotty. Thank you, Robin.
All right, peace. Okay.
Whoa. Yeah.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me.